The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One man, one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven.
This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel is Reese Davis.
The most anticlimactic championship day of the college football era is upon us. What do you make of Ryan Day's decisions and the fickle hand of coaching changes? This is the College Game Day podcast for Monday, November 28th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel. Three of the four spots in the college football playoff should be set regardless of what happens on Saturday. Michigan, Georgia, TCU all should be in, even if they lose their conference championship game. The one caveat I will allow to be at least considered, but not definitive, is if somebody gets completely blown out, you know, three or four touchdowns, and that somebody would most likely be TCU. TCU's overall schedule right now, in terms of strength of schedule, is better than the other two undefeated teams, but they lack the high-end marquee big-time win that the other two possess. So I would consider it if they were to get completely blown out by Kansas State Saturday, but I'm still inclined, Pete, that we've got three of the four spots set. If USC wins, that they're in too. So, and that's a Friday night game in the Pac-12 championship game against Utah. So while we've had a scintillating, topsy-turvy, chaotic type of season, it feels as if it's going to sort of go out with a whimper on Saturday, just to be honest about it.
Well, I think our listeners know that we tend to root for chaos, right? And there are some fun chaos theories here. I certainly am not going to discount K-State's role as a disruptor, because they have had these like spasms of greatness that have been unprecedented. You know, they're just like, I did not see 48-0 coming against Oklahoma State. So I think that there are potential places for chaos. I think every time in this sport, we assume that the things that should happen happen, we end up feeling wrong, right? Okay. So I do think there is a path towards a little bit of blandness, but I also, you know, I think of Utah, like what they've done, you know, is the tight end going to catch 16 balls again against USC?
Dalton Kincaid? Yeah, he might.
Dalton Kincaid to go for it. Like there are paths. Is USC really tougher than they were 6-7 weeks ago and can face them? I mean, they gave up, 49 points in that first matchup
I was thinking it was 43-42. I think it was
43-42 a fairly pedestrian Utah offense, right? Mm-hmm. They're not exactly making anybody remember Chip Kelly's Ducks. So I'm going to counter you, Reese, and I'm going to say I'm bracing for K. Like, there is still USC, and we've been probably more critical than most of USC, and we've been waiting for their Sonny Dykes slide, right? But it just hasn't come. But I don't go into this championship weekend thinking. I think we go into this championship weekend thinking something happens, and then there's hard decisions to be made. I think that's where the real sort of tensions come in.
I think where we differ on this is I'm with you on SC. I'm not convinced SC is going to win. And that just leaves the one spot. That definitely leaves the one spot open. They're not getting in with a loss. But if Michigan loses to the spoiler makers or LSU rises up and beats Georgia, they're both in to me. And
yes.
And if Kansas State kicks a field goal and beats TCU, I think TCU is still in and should be. Maybe I should rephrase that and say should be. Now, the 48.
I like how we always use the metaphorical scenario field goal. It's my favorite field goal.
Yeah, exactly.
If they lose on a field goal in the last second.
Okay, if they lose on a late touchdown. I'll take it a little further. If they lose 38-28, I say they're still in. Now, if you get a 2003 Big 12 championship game where Kansas State pummeled Oklahoma 35-7, and the Sooners, because of the BCS formula, still play for the national championship. If it's 35-7 or something of that ilk, then I don't think TCU is on very solid footing, and I think they probably won't make it. But everything else, any other TCU loses scenario, I still say, who's done more, who's better than them over the course of the season? They played in a very balanced, strong league. As I said right off the top, they don't have the high end win that Michigan has at Ohio State, that Georgia has against Tennessee, and really against Oregon to a lesser extent, but particularly the Tennessee win. I think they're in unless they get just blown out, or should be.
I think it's a debate, Reese. Considering the way that the power teams have been viewed through the playoff, you're ultimately saying a one loss team that played in the conference championship versus Ohio State, a one loss team, and then there's some like data coming out about Alabama that they lost twice in the last play. I just think that would be one of our more significant debates. And I reflect back to 2014 where like that Big 12, man, that thing was pushed aside. That was like a left tackle block at a Nickelback. They said, we're not getting Big 12 in this playoff. we're rolling with the Buckeyes. So there is brand bias. There is league bias that exists. Now it's a committee. So you can't say what happened in 2014 is going to happen again because it's all different humans in the room. But I do think some of those brand biases exist. I do think that you can argue that there's a talent discrepancy between both those teams and TCU. So I think TCU has had a great season, and I'm certainly not discounting it. And I would not object if they went in, but I just think it might be a little bit more of a debate than you're allowing for here. If you just look at how the committee has treated teams in the past.
Okay, well, let me be clear then.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be.
Okay.
I'll put it that way. It shouldn't be unless they get blown out, because the others that you would consider in their stead. Now, I'm not talking about SC. SC has to win because, you know, SC is a little flimsy in its resume.
No two-loss team has ever made the playoff.
They're flimsy in their resume, and they're a one-sided team. They're a great offense with a spectacular, likely Heisman-winning quarterback, and their defense is not very good. And, you know, so, but it doesn't have to be great because of the offense that they have. So I'm not talking about SC, and everybody, I think, will concede Georgia and Michigan. The 2014 debate, and the thing that will make Frog fans very nervous if they were to lose on Saturday because they fell from 3-6 on the final day despite winning by 52 points. And everybody for years has blamed it on the Big 12 championship game and the lack thereof in 2014, which I think is an absurd argument, by the way. They were co-champions, and if the committee members in 14 weren't smart enough to differentiate between Baylor and TCU because the Big 12 didn't hand them a piece of paper that said, we are declaring this team our champion, then they shouldn't have been on the committee. You know, that's why we have a committee, is to make football judgments. I think that was a football judgment that Ohio State was better than those teams. I'm not sure I totally agree with that, because also the biggest fallacy in the world is to say, well, they won the national championship. Well, that's not what we're talking about here.
Sure.
They were capable of winning the national championship. The question was, were they better at the time than TCU? I mean, or Baylor for that matter. So that was a reasonable argument and a reasonable conclusion, and one that I would have reached as well, that Ohio State in 14 was the better team. I don't see that from the two most likely contenders, Ohio State and Alabama, this year. Ohio State, maybe, but that game Saturday sort of shook my faith in them. Michigan, you know, down some players with a quarterback that hadn't, you know, really been consistent in the passing game, makes huge plays. Then they give up the, you know, just almost give up back-breaking runs. I know they had to, you know, probably bring in everybody close to the line of scrimmage, and if you squirt through, you're going to run forever, as Donovan Edwards did. But, you know, it's sort of the demoralizing way that Michigan took it to them late sort of altered my perception of the Buckeyes a little bit, to be honest. Now, I would probably, if SC loses, I would probably default to Ohio State with a one loss to Michigan, probably. But certainly my belief in them has been shaken quite a bit by the events that unfolded Saturday.
Yeah. So I stayed for the game after game day on Saturday, and we all picked the Buckeyes on the pod, right? I think all three of us did.
Yeah, I did, for sure. Yeah.
And, you know, I spent warm-up scrambling around, monitoring Blake Corum, Luke Schoonmaker, Donovan Edwards, Trevor Keegan. And, like, that was a banged-up team. And, you know, they're running walk-ons in on key possessions on the goal line, former walk-ons. So this is how much I know. I not only picked Ohio State at halftime, I said to David Pollack, I said, the way this game has gone, Michigan can't get a yard on the ground, and they're not built to win on shot plays. You know why? Because they have 11 games of empirical evidence where they were a grinded Big Ten team. I just said, I said, if I could bet the half, and we don't bet, obviously, but I said, if I could bet the halftime, like the second half line here, I would take Ohio State. Because they move the ball generally at will and, you know, kind of were having their way with Michigan's defense. And what they needed to do, which was stop the run, which was everybody's key to the game, they had done. They had done resplendently. And Blake Corum's not playing. Oh, Mike Morris is the other guy I was missing. He barely played. He played a few snaps early. He had a heavily taped ankle, and he did not look good. So I was just like, here's a team that is without its best offensive player, its best defensive player is essentially mute. And they have four other key players who are banged up. I mean, Edwards had a big wrap on his thumb, and that was, you know, in theory going to negate his effectiveness on third down because he couldn't catch the ball in the backfield. It was just, again, I thought that their, you know, Ohio State would win by 10, you know, you know, pull away and win 41-30 or something like that. Just the way that the game unfolded. The first touchdown was a zero blitz where a guy didn't make a tackle. So that didn't seem to me to be like some glaring deficiency. It was a defensive gamble gone wrong. Which didn't say, oh boy, this is worrisome. Like, you know, like if Michigan had scored on two or three 12 play 82 yard drives, I would have been like, ooh, that's not good for Ohio State. But they scored on a legit chop play that, you know, down the middle, obviously, to Cornelius Johnson. And then they scored on the zero blitz gone wrong. And it just didn't, the tenor of the game didn't indicate in any way that Michigan would go run away with it in the second half. Now, I want to be very clear, credit Michigan, because they did. They had that one just soul crushing drive. Mm-hmm. And then Ohio State had what, four straight four and outs. So yeah. Michigan did exactly what all the coaches who told me they thought Michigan were going to win do. They bodied up and they out-physicaled them and they out-toughed them and they just squeezed the life out of them. And it was very apparent. And Ohio State lost their composure. There were personal foul penalties. The defensive backs, you know, Latham Ransom's had a pretty good season and he had a really bad day on Saturday. But it was just like lack of discipline. Guys weren't turning around. They were flailing. There was obviously the key pass interference penalty in the back of the end zone. Ohio State lost its composure.
Ryan Day's taking some heat, as one will do when you lose a rivalry game. The thing that struck me about that and any suggestion that Ohio State could do better as the head coach, I'm not saying Ryan Day's greatest coach in the history of the world, but guy's lost, what, six games in his career or whatever it is. It's, you know, it's nothing. He's a terrific head coach and leader. But when you lose these rivalry games and you lose them in the fashion in which he has, there are, you know, you're going to catch some heat. Any assertion that they need to make a change is patently absurd and ridiculous. But it was interesting to see this, to see buttoned up, eccentric, but largely buttoned up, you know, we're going to run the ball and grind you out, power Jim Harbaugh, taking shot plays, having a erstwhile linebacker throw a pass, you know, in a relatively tough situation. Then seeing Day not go for it on fourth down a couple of times. Now, I'm of the Lou Holtz school, which Holtz always used to say about the players, don't come begging me to go for it on fourth down. Fourth down's my decision. Third down's your decision. You know, go get it. If you want the first down, get it on third down. So, you know, Ryan made a calculated play, but I guess pulling back in, the feeling he was pulling back in while Harbaugh was pushing the chips to the middle seemed, was that was a little jarring and something I think that Ohio State will assess throughout the offseason, or at least assess until they see Michigan again in the playoffs, should Ohio State somehow sneak into the field of four.
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe this sounds naive, but part of me thinks if they played again, it wouldn't unfold quite this way. Just because the way, you know, Ohio State led in the first half. Now, again, it would be a fascinating test of toughness. It would be a fascinating test of edge, of ego, of pride, if they did play again. So we go to all these great games, and you know, we're really lucky that to you know have all these experiences. We do go in these places, and I often think about like, what am I going to remember about this game 5 years from now? Right, when because we go to a ton of games, and they certainly don't blend together, but there is there's all these moments and experiences. So I think the one thing I'm going to remember about this Ohio State game 5 years from now is driving back to the hotel after the game. It's probably 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock with my old coworker, Dan Wetzel. He was kind enough to drive me to before I drove back to Detroit. I appreciate it. So we're in the car. He puts on Columbus Sports Radio. And it's just like he said, yeah, this will be entertaining, right? So we're talking. We're not like intently listening to it. And then I just hear the host say, you know, if you're in the Fire Ryan Day camp, and I was like, whoa, there's actually a camp? Like, that's insane. Like, I can understand frustration losing the games, but like, the guy's 45-5. I think he's only lost those two Big Ten games, right?
Those are the only two Big Ten games he's lost.
So it's like like 30-something and two. So
anyway, yeah, he's lost. Like, let's think about this for just a minute. I'll let you finish. They lost those two Big Ten games. They lost to maybe Nick Saban's best team in the national championship game. They lost a great game to a Clemson team and Trevor Lawrence. Those are four of the losses. I mean, you know, come on.
Yes. Yeah. And they had every opportunity to win that game.
And the other one was Oregon. So, you know, that.
Yes. So. Yes. So it's a, you know, I was just like, whoa. And then I saw the next morning on my way home that Luke Fickell was trending on Twitter. And this is where the news broke that he was going to Wisconsin. And I was like, why is Luke Fickell trending on Twitter? And then I realized it was Buckeye fans tweeting that they want Luke Fickell to replace Ryan Day. So anyway, I think that's totally preposterous. Ryan Day is an excellent coach.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
But I think it's also fair to say he has a Michigan problem right now. And that loss, and he was very open about it, hovered over their entire year and offseason. They were sick and tired of hearing about it. And that is only going to be amplified for the next 365 days.
Yeah, and I'm sure Michigan fans and Harbaugh, who has a sharp barb, sharp elbow every now and then to slip in there at unexpected times, I'm sure that'll come around. I want to talk about some other things, but one thing that I haven't talked to anybody about that you may be right on top of, what was the deal at running back for Ohio State with Chip Traynham carrying the load for the most part? What did he have like one carry? I may be wrong on that, but he really hadn't had the ball.
He was a linebacker a month and a half ago.
Yeah, and so you had Hayden, you had the big game against Maryland. Williams was, you know, maybe Williams didn't look himself. I kind of get that.
Yeah.
But I didn't quite understand the Hayden thing. Was there an injury of which I was unaware there to him?
I don't know. It was not I wondered the same thing. It was not explicitly addressed in the post game. He only had a handful of carries.
I think he only had two carries. That's something I think if memory serves. Yeah.
Yes. And so Ryan commented on Hayden after the game, but didn't give an explanation. There was no injury brought up, and there was, I thought Dallin Hayden would have a big game. And I thought he would get a lot of carries because you knew you couldn't rely on Mayan Williams if he's coming off the injury. And they were optimistic. Mayan Williams that week at Ohio State. They thought he would do that. But no, that's going to be one of those things that lingers from that game that just maybe there's an explanation for it, but we haven't heard it yet.
A lot of times, I would now the 14 carries, you have to continue to, you know, look at that and go, okay, well, you're going to run the ball. Why is the other guy in there? But a lot of times, Pete, I've found over the years, if you have a question about why a running back is not playing, or didn't play or didn't get a certain number of carries, wasn't on the field for a certain number of snaps. The answer is almost always, if it's not an injury, is almost always coaching confidence in their pass protection. Almost always. And so I wonder, with him being a freshman and maybe the game plan geared for the pass, that maybe that's the only, I mean, I know Ohio State fans listening to this are going to say, well, it was good enough against Maryland last week. You know, he played a lot, but, and I'm not saying that's it. I'm saying that historically, if you're saying, why isn't running back X playing for team Y? Mm-hmm. It's almost always pass pro if they're not playing.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah, Ryan has mentioned over the year, one of the Ohio State beat writers told me this when I was walking on the press box the other night, that he had talked a lot about ball security with Hayden. Now, I don't think Hayden has fumbled in a game, but that could have been an issue too. But there was another factor that was brought up to me. Phil Landis from Rivals told me that, because he'd written a good column on Hayden the week before coming out of the Maryland game that indicated that, like, this guy could be coming. And look, I thought I might have even said to Jim Guyer or a producer that, like, Dell Hayden could, like, he could carry the ball 25 times in this game for a buck. Yeah. Like, that scenario wasn't implausible to me, especially because, you know, the box is going to be a little bit light because they're going to be defending a pass. So there was going to be some room, in theory, in the run.
We had a, I like to, on this time that we're together, I like to take people a little bit behind the scenes. And if someone had been able to listen to all of the conversations and everything that was going on during the 3 hours that College Game Day was on Saturday, and even extending back to Friday night, about you working hard to nail down Matt Rhule, and then Kirk working to get Matt Rhule on the show, and I was trying to reach Trev, and just all of these different things to make sure that this was done. Then the whole Auburn scenario, and then various coaches reaching out to try to get on TV and then changing their minds and not wanting to go on TV. I'm not going to say any names. You can read between the lines and figure out who that is. So it was a bizarre, fun show that we've had over the years when we've gone to Ohio State, Michigan. I remember the 16 year, we extended the show to 5 hours. And basically it seemed
five
like,
hours?
Yeah, we started at 7 a.m. and just went. And
that must have been nuts.
And it was fun. It was really fun. And then a great game followed it. And there were so many coaching changes and decisions, and we're getting people on the phone. And, you know, it was, that was before everybody got comfortable with FaceTime and stuff. there were a lot of bizarre things going on, much of it circulating around the Auburn coaching search. Take me through what your morning was like, because at one point I was walking off of the Zotron field after that's where the big screen, no, the demo field. There are two different ones. I was walking and you grabbed me as I went by and you said, "Hey man, the Kiffin thing's falling apart at Auburn." Take me through what your morning was like.
Yeah, it was an interesting morning, Reese, and it was just hectic for a bunch of different reasons, because you had the injuries we're tracking at Ohio State and Michigan, which, you know, were key factors in that game, especially Corum. And then there was a sense, and it had been reported that Lane Kiffin was the favorite, right? That had been sort of unfolding for 24 hours. And that morning I had gotten the sense, and it actually changed what I was going to report, that things had cooled. There have been complexities in that search, some of them tied to some family stuff, and was ready to kind of go on the air and say that, you know, it's going to be it's projected to be either Freeze or Kiffin. And then Chris Lowe, our colleague, got word that Kiffin had told his staff that he was staying. And so then, you know, I went back and made some calls and kind of reported the depths of Auburn and Freeze and where it was. And as we are talking here at 10:22 on Monday morning, Freeze has still not been hired as Auburn's coach. It does seem to still be trending in that direction. But yeah, it was a lot of mornings. Like, I'm 90 seconds to air and my phone rings and I take them. You got to pull the sound thing out of your ear and there's 10,000 people. It was just like, yeah, it was, whoa. We did the first segment that I showed up on the show was our Ohio State Michigan breakdown off of the anonymous coach story. And normally I would have stayed and watched to see what like the guys had to say, because, you know, we talked about all week and I'd be curious what David had to say from his film breakdown or Dez said about Marvin Harrison Jr., but I just walked off the stage and went back and started making calls. Just like, I couldn't, it was just because the Auburn hit was coming up in like 12 minutes. Also, this is what I'll remember 5 years from now. The internet was a little spacey because, you know, you got 100,000 people descending on one thing. It's not uncommon in these college towns for your phone to not work. So I'm trying to call people. I'm trying to FaceTime audio people. The internet's kicking in and out. I probably uttered a curse word or two in our back office at a certain point at some of the technological difficulties. I probably wasn't the best version of myself in that time. But it all ended up working out. And it was certainly hectic.
Yeah, it all ended up working out on the Coach's Confidential piece, which you do an unbelievable job in giving us stuff to play off of. And we get the first one up, and that's the Zotron screen, what we call that big screen where we show it. It goes black. The two monitors that we have as backup go black. So we've got nothing. Now, I know what the quotes are. That's why, you know, you have the cards. I'm with you, the quotes, but the guys can't see the tape. So then we walked over to the edge, and I sort of guided everybody to the edge. Our stage manager was working, and we looked around the corner behind the Zotron and peered as if you're trying to get a glimpse of something far, far away, and watched on the big giant Jumbotron screen that is there for the crowd.
Yeah,
wasn't optimal. But then after a couple of guys, I think it was Kirk and Dez who ended up doing it that way. And then they, for whatever power was restored, I don't know if somebody purposely or accidentally pulled a cable or if it was just one of those glitch things, but power was restored by the third one who finished it up. And, I told them at the end that's why I like having them as teammates, because sometimes in a game, things go wrong. Sometimes you get a bad call against you. Sometimes the ball bounces a bad way. You've got to persevere and play the next play. And our guys did a really good job of that. And I was very proud of them. So, you know, any of the naysayers out there that have something to say about that, well, that's not what College Game Day was built on. It was built on being positive. As I channel my inner Saban
post-game. So it's funny, I heard in my ear, Kirk, I think, might have been up first, and I think he made a joke like, hey, how come I can't see the words? Or are you keeping it from me? Or something like that.
Yeah.
And then I ripped those out of my ears and started making
it. Yeah. So, but it worked out. It worked out well, for sure. And it was great to get Matt Rhule on. And, you know.
Yeah, we had Matt Rhule at Cape May and Marcus Freeman from Marina Del Rey.
How about that?
We literally went coast to coast on game day with good interviews on Saturday.
Okay, I want to get back to the coaching thing, but Sarah is one of our producers here, is ecstatic over the Matt Rhule hire. But prior to the start of the podcast,
think? This is what we really want to know.
Well, I think she's excited, but I think we're going to have to I asked Sarah, since she bought a Scott Frost t-shirt, is she going to buy a Matt Rhule smock? You know, but I mean, we got to do something about this ridiculous sideline attire that Matt, who I'm very fond of and like, but we've got to do something about this. This is a terrible look. He's got to do better.
I mean, Sarah, how would you look at a smock?
I personally would love a smock, anything to support the Huskers, you know, go Big Red till the end. Grammy also thrilled. Because, you know, it was a big day for us. We beat Iowa. We got Matt Rhule. It was just a beautiful, beautiful day in the house.
All right.
I asked her, Pete, who she was more excited about. And I said, this is a tough question. You have to think back. I said, but are you more excited now in anticipation of the Matt Rhule era? Or were you more excited when you got Scott Frost? It's hard to block out. What's happened in the interim, but on that day, I can't imagine that they were more excited for Rhule than they were for Frost, right?
I mean, Scott Frost's homecoming was so poetic.
Right.
It was so beautiful. That, and you mix in the t-shirt situation, like everyone was happy. Nobody was sad. So honestly, probably we were more excited for Scott Frost when he was announced. However, happy for a new era to begin.
I think
irony, Sarah, is that the depths Frost dragged you to, could make the argument that you end up happier for Rhule because there's seems to be seeds of promise. Yeah.
That's a fair assessment of the situation as well. Weekend Review is brought to you by Eckrich Smoked Sausage. Find them in the refrigerated meat aisle at your favorite grocery store to create one-of-a-kind sausage recipes. Eckrich, you do you. When Wisconsin moved on from Paul Christ in the middle of the season, which, you know, I thought was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. I'm not sure you agree with me on that. I thought it was born in embarrassment over what Brett Bielema had done on a single Saturday, their former coach coming back and holding him to 2 yards rushing and running through them and basically doing to them what they have done to others for a long time. When they fired Paul Christ, it seemed for all the world like they were lining up because there's been a faction there who's wanted Jimmy Leonard to be the head coach for a long time. Then they pivot and go Luke Fickell, which I think is a really good hire. How did this come about? Because you've been all over this story. So how did this come about with Wisconsin moving to Fickell?
So there was an interesting conundrum at Wisconsin with Jim Leonard. Excellent coach, beloved native son, elite former player. Jim Leonard's problem to me as a candidate was his strengths and his experience did not address the deficiencies that they identified when they fired Paul Christ. Those deficiencies were building a better modern program. Those deficiencies were building a better recruiting department. And Jim Leonard is a very good coach, and he's certainly a good recruiter. But he, to me, did not have enough worldview, having only played and coached at Wisconsin, essentially, to go out and figure out what it's supposed to look like, how it's supposed to look, to build the Badgers to, again, compete with the Ohio States and Michigans in that top, top tier. If you're going to fire a coach for not running a good enough holistic modern program, to me, it always felt counterintuitive to hire a coach who, again, is an excellent football coach, but doesn't have the worldview and the purview of how to do things differently. So that was always my take on Leonard. Now, if they had hired him, Jim Leonard would have done a good job. But it seems like Wisconsin's going for it here. And if you're going to go for it, you are probably better served to hire a coach who can come in and build the foundations and the guts of these modern programs. So much goes into being a college football coach now, including NIL, quite frankly. So that reality collides with Luke Fickell's reality, which was that he had gone from one of the two or three best jobs in the AAC to one of the three or four worst jobs in the Big 12. There's been concerns about anytime you jump up a league, you are going to have difficulties. You are not going to be able to compete financially. You combine the NIL aspect of it in this era, that job's even harder. Essentially, the Cincinnati job in the Big 12 is a variance of the West Virginia job. It's still a decent job, but at the end of the day, it's a difficult job and a geographic outlier, Kids in that footprint don't grow up dreaming of playing in the Big 12. Now, they don't grow up dreaming of playing in the AAC either, but there's more resonance in Cincinnati of the SEC with Lexington down the road and the Big 10 in that footprint than there is Iowa State, Texas Tech, Kansas State. So I think the surprise isn't that Luke Fickell left. The real surprise is that he hung around that long because he had been there, I believe it was 6 seasons. The first one wasn't very good. He was cleaning up Tuberville's mess. And then from there, he'd been consistently, the best group of five coach in the country, quite frankly. And Fickell had a ton of opportunities to leave, and none of the jobs seemed to fit or really make sense. Luke Fickell at his core is a Big Ten guy. And look, would he prefer the Ohio State job or the Penn State job? Maybe Michigan, although that's always fraud if you're an Ohio State guy. Sure, right? Like that's not Michigan, but this job fits so well and it fits in so many different ways that it's going to be a good marriage. And one thing we've learned about Luke Fickell is that the best quote anyone ever gave me about him, when he's not a New Year's resolution kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Like I'll make a great New Year's resolution to be on the Peloton every day, and by Valentine's Day, that'll be a distant memory. And we'll chuckle on that. So, Luke Fickell is a guy who plants roots, and he showed that at Ohio State. He showed that when he stuck around as Urban's defensive coordinator. He had a bunch of chances to leave, and he showed it again at Cincinnati when he literally built that program to unprecedented heights for a smaller school. So I think it's a great fit. I think it's a great match, and I know that he and the staff he's going to bring up there are excited. They feel like they can build that thing into into a power, into a place where, what did Brett Bimmel win? Three Big Tens there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, the ceiling is there and the vision appears to be aligned. So I think it's going to be, if you're a Wisconsin fan, it's a really good day.
Oh, I think they should be ecstatic about it. And it sometimes coaching moves are about timing for the coaches. And last year with Cincinnati going to the playoff probably wasn't the right time for Luke. There had been, you know, talk for several years because of his personal convictions and a variety of things that he coveted the Notre Dame job, as many people would. Timing wasn't right for that. He was talked about with USC. I never saw that being the right fit. But a lot of times when you feel as if maybe you missed your window, you know, with LSU, USC, Notre Dame, things like that open, you miss your window, there's a panic reaction, and you go to a place where you don't fit. I'll give you the example of one Richard Rodriguez, who had the Alabama job. You know, it worked out well for Alabama that he didn't show up when he was supposed to show up to sign on it and make it official. And then I've always felt like Rich panicked. Then took Michigan. You can't turn down Michigan, but he's not a great fit there, as that proved to be true. But in Luke's case, he didn't panic because of the non-New Year's resolution thing, I would imagine. And then when this opportunity comes up, well, this does fit him very well and provides him all of the resources that he would not have had at Cincinnati relative to the competition. So this is a... You know, his patience has been rewarded. Maybe not this may not be the job he always dreamed you would have. As you mentioned, that's probably Ohio State, Notre Dame. And then maybe, because he's probably not ever going to get the Ohio State job, then maybe, you know, then maybe Michigan. But this fits in very nicely. It's an excellent job, history of winning. People are committed to football. Money's going to be there. And he's a proven commodity. It was an excellent hire by them. Now the question is about Jimmy Leonard. Because of this, my understanding, and I don't know Jimmy Leonard well, maybe you do, but my understanding is that he largely came back to Madison because he wanted to live there and raise his family there. Sort of was talked into coaching by Paul Christ to come on the staff there. So now my question is, what does Jimmy Leonard do? Does he have the bug? Is he going to go find a head coaching job? Is he going to be a DC someplace and work his way into it? Or is the original plan back in order where he's going to live in Madison? What have you heard anything on that yet?
So, I mean, Jim Leonard's going to have options. He had turned down a bunch of really good opportunities the past few years, including the Packers DC job. I was told yesterday to not totally rule out that he could stay on Luke Fickell's staff. Remember, Luke, the same thing happened to Luke with Urban. When Urban came in, they kind of said, hey, you got to keep Luke Fickell. He's one of us. He's, you know, a promising person. I remember Gene Smith telling me when Luke got the Cincinnati job, if all of our student athletes could turn out like Luke Fickell, this place would be a really high-end place. And I feel like at Wisconsin, they think of Jim Leonard in that same vein. They think of him as sort of the consummate Buckeye. So Luke, this one interesting thing about Luke from being around him over the years, he may be the most secure head coach that I've ever met. He doesn't see ghosts. He is just very direct in how he operates. And he's just, college football coaches are not secure human beings generally. And I think you know that from being behind the scenes. And it sometimes the more successful and famous they are, the less secure they are. So Luke Fickell is the complete antithesis of that. I really think it's one of his defining qualities in most fascinating parts. He doesn't overthink things. He doesn't see he just kind of goes and operates and makes, and being a college football coach really is 1,000 small decisions every day, right? Mm-hmm. What's that training table? What time do we go? What's the weather going to be? Are we indoor? Do we offer the sophomore from Moeller? Or do we not? Like, it's 1,000 small decisions. And the more secure you are and confident you are in your decision-making, the better, you know, the better off you are. And I think that's what Wisconsin fans are really he's going to resonate with their fan base. He is all steak and no sizzle in a state that, let's face it, likes some steak.
And don't we all, although the way we pick games maybe would not be reflective of that in our race for the ribeye, though you and I enjoyed a fine steak together. One more thing about our trip to Columbus, you and I dined with some acquaintances and friends on Friday night, which is a departure for me. Typically I stay in, but there was a friend who had wanted us to come along and I was delighted to do so. And we were graced by the presence of Shemi Schembechler.
Yes, we were.
Bo's son. And Shemi
came in. We should have seen this coming.
We should have, man. And Shemi came to the show on Saturday morning, sent a very nice note along. He and his son came and had a great time. And I'm delighted to hear that. As you know, we both picked Ohio State. And after Shemi finished talking about what he believed was going to happen, and it wasn't a rah-rah kind of thing. It was just very emphatic and emotional and what it meant to Michigan. And I was like, yeah, I might run through a wall for old Maize and Blue right now after that. And he turned out to be right. But, you know, I think that I'm not really sure where I was going with that, other than the fact that we had a nice steak. We had a nice steak.
We did have a nice steak. And Bo's son, I was ready to run down on special teams. Shemi gave quite a speech about the rivalry, and his dad obviously passed before the 06 game. And that's where the line of question came up. But it was an interesting window into that world. But he lives in Columbus, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he does. That's kind of fun. Yeah, that is. There's a lot of cross-pollination there that a lot of the fans aren't aware of, you know, and he talked a lot about, and Archie Griffin has talked about this a lot too over the years, who was on the show and one of my favorite people to be around, how Woody and Bo back in the day, while they're fiercely competitive and rivals and, you know, and all of that, maintained that bond that, you know, dated back to the cradle of coaches in Miami, Ohio, and all of that. So there's more that's the thing. There's a lot of contempt. It's probably gotten more vitriolic in recent years, but the entire rivalry is built on a deep foundation of respect, or should be, you know, for the most part. And, you know, I hope the overreaction doesn't take it too much in a different direction, a little bit, because, you know, like we've talked about, we like a little pettiness, a little vitriol, a little jab to the ribs every now and then, never hurt anybody, just to stoke the fires of the rivalry, but within perspective as well. One other coach, I know he's perfectly content. He's called it his dream job, but a guy that has to be on fire right now in terms of people raising an eyebrow and looking toward the future is what Shane Beamer has done the last 2 weeks at South Carolina. First, obliterating Tennessee, and then coming from behind and ending that 7-game losing streak at Clemson. I mean, you want to talk about a rivalry and a program that changed trajectories big time in 2 weeks. South Carolina just did that.
Oh, there's no question about that. And I mean, if they turn this thing around and get back to South Carolina competing again in the SEC East in the way they did under Steve Spurrier, I think this is like the distinct pivot point, Reese. Like, you just saw it happen. I think they scored more than 90 points combined in those two games. And look, like, Clemson got rattled and made some huge mistakes, and South Carolina stayed the course. When was Clemson's last home loss? Was it 16?
I think it was the 16 game to Pittsburgh, if memory serves. And they'd won, I think it was 40 in a row at home. So I think I've got the numbers right. If I don't, and Timber Ray's listening, he'll hit me up and correct me, but they had the long home winning streak. They had the lead. They had really dominated the rivalry, and, you know, and then South Carolina goes in and changes all that and does so in thrilling fashion. One of those memorable things. And I saw that Shane tweeted this morning, I guess when he was driving his kids to school, he took the Palmetto Bowl trophy with him for the ride and encouraged all Gamecocks to walk into work with their heads held high that they had earned a little ease of the chicken curse, so to speak, as they have down in the Palmetto State. So it was just a great win for them. And, you know, really, really interesting study too, because while certainly he had had lifelong lessons in how to be a head coach from his father, Frank Beamer at Virginia Tech, I have this theory that not everybody needs to start, you know, in the MAC or in Sun Belt, you know, to cut their teeth. Now, most do, you know, most it benefits. And I'm not ever saying that's a bad thing. Some guys are ready to step into that chair. I'm not putting Shane Beamer, by the way, in the Bob Stoops category, but let's be clear about that. But Bob Stoops didn't need it. He was ready to go, you know, from the beginning. And there are certain guys who go into that seat and all of the thousand decisions a day that you mentioned earlier, they make them with ease because that's who they are. And Shane, you know, a couple years under his belt now, appears to be a guy who has made that transition quite well.
Well, certainly, Shane Beamer to me was always an interesting candidate, right? Like when you started to look at it, because special teams coaches don't tend to get hired that much, right? And so now special teams are very important. They're a third of the game. The coaches are the ones that are up in front and address the team. But I would think, you know, there's been less than 10 probably in the last 10 years special teams coaches that have become head coaches. So Tony Levine was one at Houston. That didn't work out well. There's been a handful. But for the most part, I mean, remember John Harbaugh's real background was special teams. And then became like a running back coach for 1 year and then he got hired. It's kind of this weird quirk. And Shane Beamer found out that he needed to go and sort of affiliate himself with Lincoln Riley and get some offensive pedigree to complement his special teams before he could end up, you know, going and getting that head coaching job. And so he always had an unflappable faith that he could go be a head coach and do it. And it was what a match of moment. And it took the administration there some vision to hire Shane Beamer and to go push on and do that. So it's a lot more fun when that rivalry in South Carolina is going. It's a lot more fun when the SEC East just doesn't have rocks in the basement, right? We see some embers of life from Vanderbilt. We've seen Kentucky be, you know, as good as it's been since Bear Bryant. You've got South Carolina now coming. What could have been Spencer Rattler, by the way?
He suddenly looks like a five-star quarterback that looked pretty good early in his career at Oklahoma, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. Yeah.
Now, I still contend that as a singular performance, the game they played against Tennessee was the best singular performance by any team all season, especially relative to what a team's ceiling might be. And I don't know if you picked up on this, and I hope that, you know, we like to drop the Easter eggs on the show from time to time. But when Shane was on in the pregame from the field, my last question to him was about his pregame speech. Pretty standard fare, except I asked him if he was going to let Cam Smith give the speech or if he was just going to channel that same message. Now, for those who might not be aware, in the aftermath of the Tennessee victory, the postgame, Cam Smith, Gamecocks defensive player, comes in and he was asked, because they did a better job defensively in the second half against Tennessee, and Tennessee probably got a little out of sorts and demoralized and Hendon got hurt and all of that. But they asked Cam what adjustments they made at halftime. And he said, I'm going to clean it up, but he said, no adjustments really. We just said, got to drop, you know, things that make you more mature. Okay, we'll put it that way. So he and lead you past puberty. We'll put it that's what Cam Smith said. So my last question to Shane was, are you going to do that? Are you going to? And I used the word drop so he would know exactly where I was going. That, you know, you're going to drop that info. You're going to let Cam do it or do it yourself. And he heard it and he hesitated and he goes, I might or might not have played that clip in the team meeting last night, you know, as a challenge to the guys. So he pushes right motivational buttons, done a really, really good job this year. Do you have any coaching news you want to break right now before I go into dumb loses more than smart wins?
No. I just want to break the news that my computer decided to break today, probably on the worst day of the year for it to break. So
yeah, it's not taking a charge.
That's not a good day. No.
So, dumb loses more than smart win goes to a trio of people, of which I am the leader. the trio of people would be me, Kirk, and Desmond, because we were all tied for the Superdog lead. And so we made our Superdog selections. All you need is a cover and you have a chance to win. They picked the same Superdog, and their Superdog lost 56-0, Vanderbilt. And my Superdog lost 47-7, Coastal Carolina to James Madison. Now, the people of James Madison know of my affinity for that trip there. I like Coach Signetti. I have a long-standing relationship with their passing game coordinator, Tino Sinceri, of who I'm very fond of and believe him to be a rising star in coaching. So dumb loses more than smart wins is me. That was a dumb pick. That was that. I have not made a dumber pick of all my dumb picks. That was the dumbest one, to go against the father of the Constitution, the mother of all college game day crowds, and perhaps the daddy of all transition teams from FCS to FBS. And they should be able to play in the conference championship game and all of that, but the rules about transition don't allow that, and they can't play in a bowl either. So I would like to take this moment to say this to my good friends at James Madison about my dumb loses more than smart wins pick of taking Coastal Carolina in 14.5. I offer a complete and utter retraction. The imputation that somehow the Dukes would stay close or even lose to the Shants was totally without basis in fact, and was in no way fair comment, and was motivated purely by overanalyzation. And I deeply regret any distress that my comments may have caused you or your family, and I hereby undertake not to repeat any such slander at any time in the future. My deepest apologies, because I epitomized dumb loses more than smart wins. I should have just taken Clay Helton. I would have been in good shape. Dumb ways to die. All right, did I leave you speechless? You've got no rebuttal.
No,
you've got no.
I just jabbed me on with it. I mean, you pretty much filleted yourself well enough where I felt like I'd be piling off if I did that. But that is why, like, we don't bet on football, because now Costa was pretty banged up, I think, if you look back.
Well, but, I know Grayson wasn't going to play, but I was like, this was one of those that they were begging you, and you've got to recognize it. And I did, and I did it anyway. There was also someone asked me who I was going to take, and I said, so I'm not going to call his name either. And noted, and I don't consult with many people. Maybe I bounce it off Guy Arrow, maybe Pollock or whatever, but I don't consult with anybody. It was a noted handicapper who was interested in the Superdog race and asked me who I was going to take. And I told him, and he was totally against this. So I took it under advisement, but I thought, how mad am I going to be if I change it and then think I changed it because of that? And it turns out to be right. So I sort of dug my heels in, stubbornly stuck to it. No, I didn't stubbornly stick to it. I stupidly stuck to it. I was dumb. Dumb loses more than smart wins. And I cost myself a chance for the outright Superdog. So we have a three-way tie, and all of us really should lose with making that type of pick in the clutch. So we should just award it to, I don't know. I guess Desmond won last year. Maybe he keeps it. I don't, maybe that's the way it goes. Got to knock out the champ to win.
Give it to McAfee for finishing last.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe so. I'm not sure who he picked. He might have won. Pollock went with the big game, which is against the spirit of the Superdog. He went with Notre Dame. That didn't work out for him either. So everybody in contention went 0-4, 0-4 Saturday. I'm not sure what LC and Pat did. I can't remember off the top of my head. Oh, LC won outright. He took A&M. Maybe we should just give him the belt for picking A&M to win a game.
Yeah.
And then that's knocking impressive. LSU out.
I picked in our lock of the week, I picked LSU. So.
Yeah.
One week after getting smoked in my lock of the week with East Carolina. So it's, I'm retiring from picking. I'm going to stick to breaking stories.
Yeah. Well, you do that better than anybody in the business. And I'm sure more are coming in the next few days. Two more podcasts this week on championship week. I know I've said it's anticlimactic. Doesn't mean it's not going, that it won't be fun. Going to be great. College game day is going to Dallas for Kansas State and TCU, which was a terrific game. First time around. Look forward to the rematch there. Hope you will join us on Wednesday and on Friday for more editions of the College Game Day podcast. Download them wherever you like to get your podcast. See you on Wednesday.